Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, probably the closest advisor to President Obama and to Michelle Obama during all 8 of their years in the White House, Valerie Jarrett. In a new book, Ms. Jarrett describes her fascinating family lineage, how racism that affected her research scientist father caused her to be born in Iran. She describes her career before knowing the Obamas. Jarrett mentored them, not the other way around. She was deputy chief of staff for the Chicago mayor, Richard Daley, when a young Michelle was introduced to her as a job applicant, plus her thoughts on the Obama White House years and today. The book is called Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing, and My Path Forward. Ms. Jarrett, it's an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm delighted to be with you this morning. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you. You too. The first line in chapter one is, my earliest memories are of my childhood in Iran. So since you're not of Iranian descent, how did you come to be born in Iran?
Well, that's a question I get pretty often, as you can imagine. So in the mid-50s, my father, who you mentioned was a research pathologist, was looking for a job when he was leaving the Army. And he couldn't find a position in the United States at a level equivalent to his white counterparts. And so he and my mom, who were adventuresome spirits, decided to look for opportunities outside of the United States. And he landed a job in a country he had never visited, knew nothing about the culture, the government, the language, and it was Iran. And back then, of course, the United States had far better diplomatic relations with Iran than they do today. And there were hospitals being built around the country, and physicians from around the world were coming and working with the Iranian physicians to share best practices. So my dad helped start the Namazi Hospital in Shiraz, Iran, and I was the second baby born in that hospital. I always felt sorry for the first one born, but I came along as number two, and we lived there until I was 5, and then from there my father received an offer to go to the Galton Labs at University College of London. And from there, he was recruited to the University of Chicago Medical Center, where he became the first African-American tenured professor. And he always said to me growing up, sometimes the shortest distance to where you want to go is the longest way around.
I imagine you don't want to be the first baby born in a hospital. You'd like to have a little bit of experience with it, right?
At least a little experience. That's the way I always looked at it.
Could you talk a little bit more about your father's particular experience? Because the specific racial barriers to him pursuing his research at that time might be interesting, because even today, with all we know about racism, some people might be shocked at racism stopping, of all benign things, a research scientist from getting a equivalent to his credentials job in his field.
Well, my father was used to breaking barriers. He was also the first African-American to receive a residency. And this was shocking to me. When he received this residency at a hospital in Chicago, he was told he had to come in the back door. He also was told he couldn't live in the dorms. And so he had to commute 5 miles by streetcar while the other residents, the white residents, were able to sleep, fall out of bed, and get right to work. And you know how strenuous residencies are. But he refused to go in the back door. He said, I'm a resident here. I'm a physician. I'm coming in the front. So he was used to kind of breaking trails, and he thought with his credentials, after having served in the Army, that he should be able to get a job equivalent to everybody else, and he couldn't. He looked all over the country, and there was nothing available for him. And he said, in a sense, when he went to Iran, he stopped being a black doctor, and he became an American doctor, evaluated on the merit of his performance. And that changed his life dramatically. Gave him confidence, so when he came back to the United States, he felt armed to compete and became the first tenured black professor at the medical center at UC.
And having lived just your first 5 years in Iran, were used against you by the political right with out-and-out falsehoods like that you are Iranian and Muslim, not that there's anything wrong with either of those things. Or here's an example I found when I was reading up for this interview this weekend from a syndicated columnist in 2014 that said Valerie was born on November 14, 1956 in Shiraz, Iran. Yes, in Shia-dominated Iran, which is now the self-proclaimed enemy of the United States. Her cradle language was Persian, unquote, cradle language. You hear all the implications in that. How did you deal with that sort of thing while in office?
Well, you know what? It's just nonsense. And clearly, whoever wrote that wasn't aware of the strong diplomatic relations between the United States and Iran back in the 50s.
It was when the Shah was in power. You left almost 20 years before the Islam-based revolution that brought the Ayatollahs to power.
That's exactly right. And so, look, if I were to react to every bit of nonsense that I see in the press, then I'd spend my whole day doing that. So I think my attitude, and I think the attitude of the people with whom I had the honor of serving in the White House, is let's focus on why we're here, and that's to serve the American people. And let's not make it about us, and let's not get caught up in the drama of people who are trying to perpetuate nonsense rumors. And let's just focus. And when you do that, and you look back over 8 years, I have nothing but pride.
Was President Obama also able to just tune out all the birtherism and anything else as just noise?
He did tune it out, but I have to tell you, it was a distraction, and I viewed it as dangerous. I feel like it put both he and his family at risk. It incited a lot of anger and hatred, totally unjustified, towards him over something that was made up, intended to delegitimize his presidency. But as I said, his view is you put yourself in the arena, and in this climate, people are going to say things that aren't true, and you just can't get caught up in that because it is a distraction. You have to focus on why you're there, and that's an important piece of business. I think we all recognize the privilege and honor of serving in the White House, and part of that means you have to be able to absorb pain and not let it make you numb, and certainly not let it eat you up, because that's not why you're there.
Along those lines, do you have any thoughts about the current controversy involving Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Trump? Some people are more offended by her referring to the 9/11 attacks as simply some people did something, in making a point about discrimination against Muslim Americans as a group for that. And some are more offended by Trump tweeting an image of the burning World Trade Center in response. If you and President Obama were still in office, how would you advise him to respond to the comments, or the New York Post publishing the Trade Center photo and really launching the president in that direction?
Well, look, I think it's the job of the person who is the president of the United States to set an important tone at the top. And I think that the congresswoman has expressed regret for some of her comments. She's a freshman congressman. She's learning. She's made it clear that she's learning. And to attack her in a way that puts her in harm's way, I just think is deeply, profoundly disturbing. I was listening to the news this morning, and I heard that she and her family are now getting increased number of death threats. She was already getting them. She has three small children. And I just think that we're better than that. And we can disagree about issues. We can go at it over policy. But why are we putting an image up that we know is designed to incite hatred and disgust and potentially violence? I just think that's the opposite of what the President of the United States should do.
My guest is Valerie Jarrett, who was senior advisor to President Obama for all 8 years and knew both Obamas before that. Her new book is called Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. And we can take a few phone calls for Valerie Jarrett at 212-433-WNYC. And I know sometimes people call about the last thing out of our mouths, so don't call about Ilhan Omar and President Trump. Let's talk about things from Valerie Jarrett's life and career and the issues that she dealt with and going forward. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tell the story of when you were Deputy Chief of Staff to Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, when a job applicant named Michelle Robinson, engaged to a young guy named Barack, came to apply for a position. It seems like from the book, she impressed you right away. How do you remember that first meeting?
I remember it vividly. She walked in and she was tall and simply dressed, barely any makeup on, her hair pulled back. She reached out, she shook my hand and looked me in the eye with confidence. And when she sat down, she glanced and saw her resume was sitting on my desk. And Brian, she never mentioned a single thing on her resume, no Princeton, Harvard, etc. She told me her story, and it's a story that now so many people around the country and the world realize is the American story. Growing up in a kind of a working-class neighborhood, parents had not finished college but believed in education, encouraged both she and her brother Craig to get a good education. And then And then really raise them with the spirit of to those who much is given, much is expected. And that's what led her to want to pursue a career in public service. And she didn't know whether she wanted to go to the mayor's office or serve in some other way. But what she told me that day was that she was committed to service. Her father had been a precinct captain. That kind of teased her interest in local government. And I was so blown away, I offered her a job on the spot. She wisely demurred. And a few days later, I was calling to check on whether or not she was going to come on board. And she said, well, we have a problem. My fiancé doesn't think it's such a good idea. And I said, well, who's your fiancé and why do we care what he thinks? And she chuckled and said, his name is Barack Obama. And he began his career as a community organizer. And he has some concerns about, well, me going from a private, big private law firm right into the mayor's office. And I'd gone from a big law firm, but I'd gone and practiced law for 4 years in the city government before the mayor's office. So he said, look, you had some preparation. What about Michelle going right into the fire? And then she said, well, would you have dinner with the three of us to talk about it? And quite wisely, I said yes.
You mentioned Obama being a community organizer at that time. I want to play a clip that you surely know from the 2008 Republican convention. Obama at that time is the Democratic nominee, and speaking at the Republican convention is Rudy Giuliani, who of course had been mayor of New York City, and he mocked Obama's early political activity as if it was something from Mars.
You have a resume from a gifted man with an Ivy League education. He worked as a community organizer. What? He worked. I said, I said, okay. Maybe this is the first problem on the resume.
All right. I don't know what they were chanting there. It wasn't lock him up yet, but whatever it was, community organizers set them off. And I think that clip tells us a lot more about Rudy than it does about Obama, that a mayor of New York City would have been so dismissive of community organizers or pretend like he didn't even understand what kind of a real thing that is. I'm curious if you remember hearing that and your reaction to it at the time.
I remember hearing it, sure, and I remember thinking, well, we'll see about that. And as it turns out, that community organizer was elected president not once, but twice.
Did you hear that as racially coded, like, you know, another black person pretending to be qualified by pretending to work or something?
I just thought it was dismissive and intended to denigrate his credentials. But I actually believe that the community organizing background is what enabled him to go state by state and galvanize so many people to come out and vote for him. So it worked. But there were a lot of comments at the time that were dismissive and derogatory. And what impressed me about the president then, when he was just the senator, is that he really just said, okay, fine, I'll just work harder. And I know I have to lift up my hood and let people kick my tires and see why they should trust me to have this most important job in our country. And I'm willing to do the work to get there. And so every time somebody would say something like that, he would just work that much harder.
Shadow in Tribeca, you're on WNYC with Valerie Jarrett. Hello, Shadow.
Hi, Brian. I love your show. And thank you, Ms. Jarrett, for your service.
Thank you.
I love President Obama and the First Lady. And I just want to know, how did you guys do it 8 years without any scandal? And the ethics standard to the highest of any administration in American history. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that lovely question, framed the way you did. I think we followed a lesson my father taught me when I was a young child, and that is color well within the lines. And if you do that, then you are less likely to get in any trouble. And I was one of the co-chairs of President Obama's transition team, and he made it very clear to us that he wanted people who shared his values, who were committed to improving our country and creating opportunity for every American. But he also wanted to make sure that people were there who appreciated the fact that our children are looking up to us as public servants, and we need to comport ourselves in a way that will give them something to which to aspire. and that means being free from scandal. And so in the end, I remember the last dinner President Obama had after the 2016 election with his senior staff. So it was our last annual dinner, and he teared up when he said, "I'm so proud of the fact that there's no one in this room who did anything to embarrass our country, that you comported yourselves well."
Valerie Jarrett, my guest, former senior advisor to President Obama for all 8 years, now the author of Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing, and The Path Forward. Trump is more about reducing immigration than any other single thing, it's probably fair to say. And I read that in 2014, you once had dinner with Rupert Murdoch to develop a bipartisan immigration strategy. The conservative Washington Examiner called Murdoch at the time a new White House frenemy of sorts on immigration reform. Can you recount that dinner and whether it launched a meaningful effort at that time?
Yes, very vividly. I had a couple of meals with Rupert Murdoch, and our philosophy was this. We'll work with whoever we can to find common ground. And I can disagree with you about 99 issues, but if we can agree on one, then let's work on that one. And Rupert Murdoch, an immigrant himself, felt very strongly that we needed a comprehensive immigration policy in this country. And given his standing with conservative Republicans, we thought it would be helpful to work with him to launch a bipartisan strategy. And he, in fact, wrote a very profound editorial for the Wall Street Journal explaining why he believed it was good for business, consistent with our values as a country, and important to move forward. And unfortunately, the Republicans in Congress decided not to move forward at that time, but there certainly was bipartisan support around the country for it. We had law enforcement, we had conservative groups, we had faith-based organizations who were profoundly concerned about the separation of families. We had the business community and certainly a range of advocacy groups. And we wanted it to be bipartisan. It needed to be bipartisan in order to get Congress to act, but they refused to act.
Are you surprised, then, that Fox News Channel has allowed itself to go as much full Trump as it has on immigration, given Murdoch's own views?
Well, I suppose it is an indication that his views don't influence the Fox programming. But it is disappointing that Fox isn't being more part of the solution and recognizing that our current policies of separating children from their parents and deporting one or the other and not having any system in place to reunify families is not who we are as a country. It is just, it is inconsistent with our core values.
So here we are in the Trump era, and a review of your book by Harvard professor Randall Kennedy in SF Gate wishes you had addressed a question that he thinks about. He writes, "Jarrett offers no opinion regarding the extent, if any, to which the Obama administration bears responsibility for the ascendancy of Trumpism." What would you say to that?
Well, look, I think that after the 2016 election, I did a lot of thinking about what happened here. I didn't see it coming. I was surprised by the outcome of the election. And as I went through the stages of grief, and I went through them often all in one day, I think where I came out was we are in trouble when 43% of the American people don't vote. That a democracy is based on everybody turning out to vote. And I was particularly concerned that sometimes people who don't vote are the people who are most likely to be adversely affected by the outcomes of those elections. And so one of my initiatives that I am quite passionate about right now is an organization that Mrs. Obama and I formed last summer called When We All Vote. And it is nonpartisan, and it is designed to encourage people to appreciate their civic responsibility of voting and engaging. And I get it. People look at government, state, local, and federal sometimes, and they just say, oh, my gosh, what a mess that is. But the only way that we change that is if people recognize their own agency and and get involved and get engaged.
Sure, and that's
so
a good.
I do not think that the Obama administration was responsible for the outcome of the election at all, and that's why I didn't address it in my book.
Could the Obama administration have done more to prevent the white backlash that contributed to Trump's election?
Well, I think that the energy that came in favor of President Trump was something that was generated outside of President Obama's White House. So we didn't create the backlash. That fire was ignited by those who wanted to use it for a political purpose. And I have always felt that we should be appealing to what we have in common, to your comment earlier about Rupert Murdoch. We should be trying to figure out how to pull our country together and make it inclusive and not fund or promote the kind of the polarization of America, which we've been seeing. And that was the speech President Obama gave back in 2004. That's why I do not believe he contributed to this. I think those who were outside of the White House, who were really promoting this agenda and creating a sense that it's a zero-sum game, and if you do well, then I must do worse, as opposed to let's increase the size of the pie, that's where the responsibility lies, not with President Obama.
We have about 2 minutes left, and with the Mueller investigation report, whatever version is not redacted, coming out soon, I've heard the president, President Obama, and you and the general, you know, top levels of the administration criticized from both sides, either for being too passive and letting that kind of stuff take root during the campaign, or for authorizing surveillance against members of the Trump campaign in a way that was meant to tip the scales. What would you say about the conversations that you did have with the president at that time when you realized it looked like something might be going on?
Look, I think President Obama made it clear that he supported Hillary Clinton. He campaigned on her behalf. But as president of the United States, he had to be very, very careful about not using that office to tilt the scale one way or the other. And what he did do was he called upon Leader Mitch McConnell and asked him if he would jointly issue a statement and work with the Republican secretaries of state around the country to be vigilant about ensuring that the elections weren't experiencing any tampering. And the Republicans, well, Mitch McConnell refused to do that. So we made an effort to try to take this out of the political arena and focus on the substance of ensuring a safe and fair election, and reached out to try to get their leadership to do that, knowing that if we just did it by ourselves, it could be perceived as political. And they refused to do that. And that's putting short-term political interests ahead of what's best for the country.
Valerie Jarrett, she was senior advisor to President Obama all 8 years of that administration. She's the author now of Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward. She's also chairman of the board of When We All Vote, which she was just talking about, co-chair of the United States of Women, and a senior advisor to the Obama Foundation. And thank you so much for doing one of your book interviews with us. Good luck with When We All Vote. The more we vote, the better a country this is. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Brian. Take care. Have a great day.